Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
In early 2013, KERA began an ambitious project to follow a diverse group of students who would graduate from high school in 2017. You've heard these stories as part of our American Graduate Initiative. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The students featured in the project were in eighth grade when we started. College back then was a goal for most of them, but also felt like a distant dream. Today, they are finishing up their junior year in high school and beginning to navigate school visits, SAT and ACT tests, and looking ahead to apply to their chosen institutions. With these students, their classmates, and their parents in mind, we've invited back one of the most talked-about guests from the past year of Think. Julie Lithcott-Hames is former dean of freshmen at Stanford University and author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kid for Success. She also hosts the Slate Panoply podcast, Getting In, about the college application process. She joins us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative and our current series, What's Next for the Class of 17. Julie, welcome back to Think.
Chris, thank you so much for having me back.
How important is junior year specifically for college-bound students?
Well, the American narrative is that junior year is a four-letter word that begins with an H and ends with two L's. And I think there's some truth to that. The junior year is sort of that final full year when a student can acquire the various bits, the various experiences they'll want to have in their arsenal so as to put forward kind of the strongest effort when it comes to applying to college. So it is a big deal. It is that final full year.
What, besides keeping up with schoolwork, should happen during junior year?
Yeah. Well, I think for any young man or woman thinking about applying to college as a senior, the junior year, let's face it, we're now in spring. Some of them have already graduated. You know, looking ahead, it's time to buckle down around standardized tests. Am I going to take the ACT or the SAT? Most colleges require one or the other, although there are 800 plus colleges that don't. You can find out about them on fairtest.org. But basically, you know, if the colleges you're wanting to apply to are going to require it, you've got to sit for that test, maybe take it a few times to improve your score. So testing. Also looking ahead to who's going to be writing my letters of recommendation. Most colleges are going to want a letter or two or three from someone who knows you well. Not a famous person who kind of sort of knows you, but someone who actually knows you, knows how you think, believes in you. You want to approach that person now. That person might be busy writing other people's letters. Mm-hmm. Approach them now and say, hey, might it be possible for you to write me a letter of rec for college? You know, give the person the appropriate time to think about it and the appropriate time to write it.
How should students decide whether the SAT or ACT is better? And you say neither one should be taken more than twice for most students.
Well, boy, standardized testing is a subject for another show. That is, the merits, you know, should we have these things in the first place? But for the present context is, yeah, we've got them. Most places require them. The SAT, as listeners will know, recently really revamped itself. So this winter was the new SAT for the first time, which apparently looks a lot more similar to the ACT. I can't say for sure. I've never seen it. But there is apparently less of a distinction these days than there was even as recently as last year. So I would say pull down a practice book, you know, get a sense either from the web or from a book you can get at a library or a bookstore that helps you, you know, that gives you sample questions for each test and discern whether I'm more of an ACT person or an SAT person. Or don't be so worried about it and just go with one. There, I think, is no college that accepts only one of them. So it's really, you know, pick whichever one you want to pick and go for it. And yeah, taking it a second time. I mean, tests go up the more kids prep for the tests and retake them. So there's a value in taking a test, seeing how you do, and then trying to improve, you know, study a little bit harder in the areas where you weren't as strong and take it again and have confidence that that score is likely to rise.
Harvard is calling for giving less weight in university admissions to standardized test scores and AP courses. Now, it's just Harvard, but Harvard has a lot of influence on what less elite schools do. What's the thinking behind this, and what would the effect be on students applying?
Well, You know, I think you're referring to that Harvard Graduate School of Education report, Turning the Tide. And, you know, I'm thrilled to see them take the lead on this, thrilled to see many, many other schools say, heck yes, we agree. And here's what they're responding to. It has become possible to just achieve a better standardized test score for yourself the more you prep for it and you retake it. Who can afford to do that? The people who can afford to do that. And I mean afford in the monetary sense.
Yeah.
So who does this disadvantage? Poor kids, low-income kids who don't have the wherewithal, the means, the opportunity to kind of keep retaking those tests. APs, you know, in theory are a wonderful way to do really advanced work. But what's happened is in school districts like the one my kids attend, Palo Alto Unified School District here in California, and many school districts in the North Dallas area, you know, more affluent communities, schools are offering 10, 15, 20, 22 different AP courses. And kids in those schools feel pressure to take as many as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So they're filling their entire junior year and senior year, maybe even a lot of their sophomore year, with advanced placement courses. I think, you know, Harvard and others are scratching their heads saying, wait a minute, in what rational society are high school sophomores actually capable of taking college level classes? Why do we act like that's normal? It's not. We've just sort of gotten out of whack with the degree of kind of rigor and effort we expect a high school student to put forth to be attractive to a college. So that Harvard report is, I think, very wisely suggesting, could we put a bit of a lid on this, the number of APs we want students to have taken to be qualified applicants? Because if we don't put a lid on this in 5 years, we'll think it's normal for kids to take, you know, twice as many as they are now.
Yeah.
So I really applaud that report.
What are schools looking at besides grades and scores and class rank?
Well, you know what they really care about is, who is this human?
Mm-hmm.
Who is this human? Who will they be in the classroom, and who will they be in our community? So they care about character, actually. And character includes work ethic. You know, they want to know that you've worked hard, that you care about your studies, that you want to make something of yourself. And grades and scores are a sort of shorthand toward discerning that. But, you know, beyond what grades and scores can tell, in your essay, for example, they want to know, what interests you? What is that one thing that, you know, you're passionate about? And I want to digress here and say, boy, we've done a number on passion. You know, we tell every kid now, find your passion quick. You know, find your passion by November 1st if you're applying early, because colleges want to see it. Passion is this rudder that should guide a human through their life. It's the answer to the question, why do I do what I do? Did any of us, you know, grown-up listeners out there, how many of you had found your passion by 17? Give me a break. I hadn't. You know, Chris, I don't know if you had.
No.
Very often, if we thought we had, we changed our minds, and that's okay. But these days, it's like, find your passion, write it down, impress a college. Okay. Colleges, let's take the kind of the weight out of the word passion, and let's tell high schoolers, look, colleges are interested in what you're interested in. All right. Poorly constructed sentence, but tell them who you are. Tell them the things you actually enjoy doing. Tell them what you're curious about. This is in the essay. Tell them, you know, that injustice that drives you crazy. Tell them that time you stood up for something. Tell them about that time you didn't stand up for something and really, really regretted it. They want to know who you are and what makes you tick. And actually, the more unique you can dare to be without being weird, you know, the more unique you can dare to be, you're distinguishing yourself from the many, many other applicants who will have similar grades and scores to you. You sort of conform to their expectations by having the grades and scores they've indicated impress them. Then you got to differentiate yourself from all those people who conformed to those expectations by daring to tell them who you actually are.
I will cop to being guilty of this more than once. I've got four teenagers at home, and
yeah.
The sentence, this would look good on a college application, has escaped my lips.
Me too.
How much should students tailor their activities to what they think colleges want?
Oh, Chris, let me... look, I'm a mom. I should have said that right up front. I got a 14-year-old daughter, freshman in high school, got a 16-year-old son, class of 17, right there in with it, with your wonderful class of 17 kids you're following. I think we should do our best as that thought, this would look good for college, as it forms in our brains. We should try to stop it as it lands on our tongue and prevent ourselves from actually saying it out loud. Hmm. Okay, it's natural for us to think it, but here's what's happened. We've let colleges and actually U.S. News and World Report, because they're telling us which colleges are good enough.
Yeah.
We've let those outside third parties decide, dictate how we raise our kids and how they live their childhoods, which is absurd. Okay. So here's an example of how I have, in furtherance of raising my kids to be an adult, right? Because I'm the college dean that saw too many college kids, you know, beautifully prepared in a resume and GPA and transcript sense, but not very familiar with doing the work of life for themselves. Okay. I want to raise my kids to be able to do the work of life for themselves, whatever campus they end up on. You know, fill out their own forms, keep track of their own deadlines, talk to the adults in their own life, like their professors, not expect me to do it for them. Okay. So in furtherance of that, our kids actually have to learn the hard way about actions and consequences. So my son is a biology guy. He thinks he wants a PhD in genetics. Okay. He's 16 and he knows that about himself. Beautiful. Mm. What do I know as a former dean at Stanford? I know that colleges would love to see a young person like him do some research over the summer. Okay. It would be a way to deepen his knowledge in the field. It shows effort. It shows interest. And I have been mentioning to him since he was a freshman in high school, hey, honey, doing research in science over the summer would be, you know, really beneficial. It'll deepen your knowledge in the field. And I have tried not to say, and colleges want to see it too. Okay. But then gently, I've been saying sort of like, and, you know, colleges will be impressed by it. And he's like, Mom, I just need downtime. I just can't cram my summer. You know, this is a kid who's doing so much homework. He's so busy during the school year. And I get it. I want my kid to have the kind of summer you had and I had. But I know in the back of my mind, he should want to do these things. He should do these things whether he wants to or not. So I've been nudging for about 2 years, 2.5 years, and then, but not doing it for him. I mean, I could send an email to some former friends who, you know, are in the bio department and set up a summer internship for him. But I'm not gonna. Okay, I'm holding on that because he has to want it badly enough to write the email himself, to put that effort into it himself. Otherwise, he'll show up in somebody's lab and his parent will have manufactured the opportunity for him and it'll go on his resume, but that kid will not have learned how you procure an opportunity like that for yourself. Okay, so this is sort of this careful balancing act we must do as parents. Their lives, their activities should not simply be in furtherance of what a college wants. We should actually be more interested in them developing, you know, this intrinsic motivation to work hard, you know, to impress somebody with their hard work, to move forward in the direction of their own dreams, not to have us dragging them down, you know, the path of their life.
What do you recommend to students who have been, let's just say, a little delayed in developing that intrinsic motivation? People whose teachers know they have a lot of promise, who may be interested in things but don't look so good on paper.
I would say that sounds perfectly human and perfectly normal. And it's terrifying for us parents when we have a kid like that, particularly when we know they have potential. You know, I've interviewed someone in my book in Michigan who says, my eldest, smarter than me and my husband, we both have PhDs and we know he's smarter than us, but he's not doing a darn thing in high school. And I think, you know, so she and I had this conversation. It's like, as long as he's not got a, you know, mental health problem, like he's not depressed, he's not, you know, a drug addict, you know, there isn't a problem getting in the way of his motivation. Let's accept the fact that he may not blossom as a 16, 17, 18-year-old like many of us didn't. Many people do not hit their stride in terms of their kind of intellectual, academic, you know, passion until college or after college, the workplace, grad school. You know, we have to realize that a human life is long, and this notion that this perfected childhood is somehow the goal in furtherance of admission to some college we think is going to make or break their life. It's just wrongheaded thinking. We need to have high expectations for that kid. Hey, kid, homework is important. You need to be doing your homework. You know, we have expectations that you pitch in around the house and do chores, you know, that you're kind to other people. You have four options out of high school: college, the workplace, the military, or a gap year. You know, pick one of those and move toward it. Don't let, you know, your future just happen to you.
Let me jump in here.
Appreciate
we have to take a quick break. My
yes.
guest is Julie Lithcott-Hames. Her recent book is called How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, and I'm talking this hour about college readiness with Julie Lithcott-Hames. She's the former dean of freshmen at Stanford University, author of the book How to Raise an Adult, and host of a Slate Panoply podcast about the college application process called Getting In. Our conversation is part of KERA's American Graduate Series, What's Next for the Class of 17. One of the students we've been following since eighth grade is Joel Luera. He is wrapping up 11th grade in what's known as early college high school. Stella Chavez reports on how it's going for Joel and what he's been doing to prepare for life after high school.
There's no question Joel Luera is a standout. He's ranked number 4 in his class, he's a champion debater, and he takes courses on a college campus. But this school year hasn't been easy.
It's been different. That's one thing they kind of don't tell you when you go to, I guess, like here, is that you still got to go through all the high school stuff, like, you know, the quote-unquote discovering yourself and all that thing that is a part of growing up, and you still got to do all that.
Joel spends his days at Eastfield. That's a community college in Mesquite with 14,000 students. He's one of more than 200 juniors and seniors there from the early college program at Samuel High School. Like many college kids, Joel's got a heavy schedule. Last semester, 20 credit hours. This one, 18 hours. Last fall, some personal stuff got in the way. Joel, who just turned 17, had a girl problem, and that kind of derailed him.
It wasn't a very good time for me because, like, I had a lot of negativity, and, like, I don't get anxious, but, like, I think of things, like, a lot and try to think of all the outcomes and stuff.
Joel ended up with a D in speech and C's in algebra and English. He did ace U.S. history and Spanish and got a B in biology. Like any good debater, Joel's developed critical thinking skills, so he analyzed the problem.
It was a lack of prioritization. Teenagers aren't very good at prioritizing at all. Like, I look back on it, and it's like there's these things that I thought were like the end of the world for me, and they weren't.
Here's the thing. Junior year is pivotal. It's those grades colleges look at when deciding whether a kid gets in or gets a scholarship. Samuel's early college program is competitive. There are interviews, recommendation letters, and a lottery to get in. Most of the kids are the first in their families to try for college. Caitlin Buford is program coordinator.
We look for grit. We look for that student that is hardworking and that maybe doesn't always have the best scores and or the best grades, but they work hard. And, you know, maybe we can see some improvement somewhere, a little bit of growth.
9th and 10th graders who are accepted take core classes in a separate wing of the school in Southeast Dallas. They spend the last 2 years at Eastfield. By graduation, they can earn a high school diploma and an associate's degree. This year's class of 57 seniors will be the first to finish early college. Half got an associate's last weekend. What it takes is discipline.
You have far fewer instructional face-to-face minutes on a college campus. You're responsible for quite a bit more on your own time outside of class than you are in a high school classroom. You have far fewer grades often. You know, we have 18 grades per 6 weeks in DISD. In a college classroom, you might have 5 or 6 for an entire semester.
That means fewer chances to mess up and recover. Buford points to the way Joel's rebounded. He started the year with a 4.0 and has enough credit hours to make up for last fall's troubles.
He's been just above and beyond dedicated to everything that he does. You know, as a 10th grader, passed all of the college readiness tests, the TSI, to take classes in math, reading, and writing, which is impressive. So this is 3 years early.
Joel's also become something of a leader. As a junior, he's already captain of the Samuel debate team and even judges a few tournaments. At an event at Townview last fall, Joel showed up despite battling a stomach bug. He and his debate partner sat at a table talking strategy. A younger kid on the team asked for help.
So if you don't have no questions to ask, do you have to ask questions?
No. I mean, it looks bad if you don't have questions since you're all running the same thing.
These are complex topics. Cyber threats, national security, Their style of debate is called spreading. They go really fast.
Kitty cooperative cyber defense overcomes legal barriers. Significant fraction of the policy debate about cyber security.
Boston cyber defense is key. Bennett 2015. Russia has mapped cyber
attacks. Have a major impact on zero-D markets since the international market dominated national security organizations.
Schools around the country are debating the merits of early college. There are nearly 300, and 8 more are launching this fall in Dallas. So do they work? 2 years ago, Joel Knutson of the American Institutes for Research co-authored a study of this approach.
We saw better outcomes while those students were in high school. So students who attended early colleges or who were accepted to early colleges graduated at higher rates. Early college students graduated, 86% of those students graduated from high school as compared to only 81% of the comparison students.
The researchers found something even more compelling.
That by the end of high school, 64% of early college students had enrolled in college, and only 24% of comparison students had enrolled in college, which is a promising finding.
Joel's betting his big ticket to college is debate. His top choices, UT Austin and Dartmouth, or maybe Columbia, or even Harvard. He's already getting a taste of what it takes.
It's what it is. Like, that's the biggest thing you learn here, is that you're responsible for yourself and you have to take care of yourself.
As junior year wraps up, that's a challenge everyone in the class of 17 is facing. Stella Chavez, KERA News.
Explore our series, What's Next for the Class of 17 series, online at kera.org/class of 17. You'll also find a list of resources to help students search for a college. Back now to my talk with Julie Lithcott-Hames, former dean of freshmen at Stanford University. Julie, when you hear a student like Joel Luera, it sounds like he's got everything that you are encouraging students to develop.
Yeah, boy, I was really impressed listening to Joel. Very excited for him and his future. Listen to what he said right at the end. What I've learned is, I'm paraphrasing, what I've learned here is you're responsible for yourself. You have to take care of yourself. That's it, folks. That's it. We parents will not always be able to attend our kids' every need. We wish we could, but we can't. We will predecease them, hopefully not for decades, but we will, and we need to know that our kids have got it. There's nothing like, you know, the opportunity to be independent on a campus, whether it's in high school or actually in the college years, to teach you that. Like, kid, you got to fend for yourself. And life comes with ups and downs, and Joel has sort of experienced that. Sounds like a terrible situation, and it derailed him academically. And guess what? That happens. That's part of the human experience. We all struggle. Our kids need to not be prevented from having every struggle. As many parents listening would think, my God, how could Joel's parents have let that happen? What would I have done if my kid was facing, you know, C's or God forbid worse? You know, I need to swoop in and fix that. And we have this motivation to fix, but actually learning that lesson from the struggle is going to make Joel a stronger person. And as this woman, I didn't catch her name, but the woman who's obviously on that college campus at Eastfield speaking to how talented he is, she should write him a letter of recommendation. This gets back to my point about great letters of recommendation are from people who know you well, know what you've contended with and how you've handled it and how you've grown. So absolutely, I'm thrilled for him. And I think his story is both terribly unique to him and really, really a great example of what any human can go through and how any human emerges from it stronger.
The last time you and I talked, we discussed your book, How to Raise an Adult, which I'll tell you has become like a secular Bible for a number of people in my set.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Many people have observed, though, that because of the way we parent or overparent today, young people often leave high school having had fewer opportunities to build resilience, to build independence than previous generations did. They struggle when they get to college academically or they struggle emotionally. How can parents know their students are indeed ready to leave home as opposed to maybe staying close to home for another year or two and completing their studies, doing some studies there?
Oh, my gosh. This is, I think, the $64,000 question. Let's adjust that for inflation. I don't know what it would be, but I am so in this with my 16-year-old. I'm looking at him, and he's terribly accomplished in a, you know, resume and transcript sense, and I'm wondering how will he fend when he's out in the real world. I joke here in Palo Alto and Silicon Valley that we're more likely to create a hardship summer camp for our kids. You know, colleges want to see kids with grit and resilience, and childhood is too coddling, so let's give them a summer camp. We take away their phones for a whole day, and make them suffer a little bit so that they develop a thicker skin. I mean, I joke. Don't anyone listening to this say, in Palo Alto, they have a summer camp that teaches hardship. No.
Just $4,800, right?
Right. I'm joking that we would solve it that way because that's easier than stepping back and saying, why is childhood no longer naturally teaching our kids to be strong, which is what we kind of mean by resilient? Okay. So, and there's no question at the college level, folks are struggling. You know, places like Harvard and Stanford, for example, both have efforts around building resilience in their undergraduates. They say our students are failure deprived. They've gotten here. Their path has been smoothed, overhelped. They've achieved a lot. And when the first thing goes wrong, like a B or a tiff with a roommate or rejection from a club, they have absolutely no wherewithal within their own psyche to handle it and they fall apart. All right. So what do we do? We have to tolerate things going wrong in the lives of our kids. Not invited to a birthday party, missed a deadline to apply for something they wanted, broke something and there's a consequence. We have to, in my book, I excerpt a section from the book called Gist, written by two guys in Minneapolis. The excerpt is, mistakes and curveballs we must let our kids experience so that they grow stronger and are more prepared for adulthood. And you will wince when you see this list. It's things that are slightly painful. What parent would want that? None of us wants it. But we must desire the growth that comes from it. When we can sit with them and say, yeah, that must have felt really bad. You know, I know that must have hurt. And we can actually share with them, you know, that happened to me once. I lost a friend or I missed a deadline or I missed out on something and it really upset me and I was just not myself for 2 or 3 days, but then I just picked up and moved on. Kids need role models for how to handle struggle. They need to know that life goes on. Instead, we tend to act like every single aspect of their lives is a make or break moment for this tremendous future we have in mind for them. So of course they freak out because we're freaking out. Like, oh my God, you missed that. What are we going to do? Your future is over. No, their future is not over. They are 2,800 accredited colleges and universities in this magnificent nation of ours. There is room for everybody somewhere. And it's who that kid is when they get there that determines whether they'll be successful. You know, not how good was your mom or dad at making sure you did all your work or met all your deadlines.
And that's where the parental anxiety comes in, isn't it? Because we feel like if they're not the very best, it means we weren't the very best parents.
Exactly. And that, I think, is about parental ego. That's about us feeling better or worse if our kids are doing well or not. You know, we crave that bumper sticker for the back of our car that lists the private high school they're in, if that's the circumstance, or it lists the college they're going to. We feel better about ourselves. And my goodness, boy, is that unhealthy. Carl Jung has said one of the greatest harms to a child is the unlived life of the parent. It's not good for them. It's not good for us. Of course, we adore them fiercely. They're our kid. And yet, we can't be so wrapped up in every moment as if somehow every single thing is of consequence. They're children. They need a chance to try and fail. I refer to these five beautiful F words: fail, flail, flounder, fumble, fall. You know, these things happen. It's not that we should prevent all that. We need to help them learn that they get back up when those things do happen.
You said earlier that upon high school graduation, the options are college,
yeah,
military, civilian workforce, or gap year. Talk about the gap year and if it happens, what it should look like.
Well, Malia Obama has made the gap year quite a popular hit word on Google. All of a sudden, everyone wants to know, what the heck is that? Little disclaimer, I'm on the board of Global Citizen Year, which is a gap year organization. And it, like many other organizations, has fashioned an opportunity for high school graduates to go do something useful out in the world for approximately a year. And the point is, grow some skills. When a human is outside their comfort zone, let's face it, the comfort zone is where we're comfortable. So in order to grow, we got to be slightly outside of our comfort zone. We got to take on a few risks, deal with the uncomfortable and the unfamiliar, learn, fall, grow. Okay. So a gap year, like Global Citizen Year, is an opportunity to go somewhere else, maybe live with a host family, do some work, try to be useful, and grow and learn some actual skills, but more importantly, I think, develop a stronger sense of who am I, what matters to me, you know, strengthen one's character, develop more resilience. Global Citizen Year is noteworthy in that it offers a lot of financial aid. Many of people think gap year is only for the well-to-do, but that is not true. A place like Global Citizen Year offers financial aid to young people. So, look, if a student isn't ready, if high school has been a grind and the student is burned out, not a great sort of mindset with which to launch a college career. A year away that is productive, not a year watching Netflix on your parents' couch, but a year that has work, a year that has service, a year that entails growth outside the comfort zone, that's a really valuable year. And, you know, we're starting to see Global Citizen Year is rather young, but we're starting to see they perform better once they do get to high school, once they do get to college, excuse me, more mature. So it's it can be a very valuable thing. So there's something called the American Gap Year Organization. If people are interested, Google that. Yeah, plenty of opportunities there.
Best to apply to school and defer admission or apply in the middle of that gap year?
Well, these days, I think people, because gap year hasn't, you know, in Europe, it's very common, in America, not yet. And so people are really reluctant to not apply to college in, you know, on track. Most kids right now are applying to college and then they're looking at those college options and saying, maybe I want to take a gap year. That's not ideal. Ideally, they would say deliberately, you know, the start of high school senior year, hey, I'm not going to be ready to go to college next year. I want to take a gap year rather than as a response to college admissions results. So plenty of people do get results from a college, you know, accept an offer, but defer it, do the gap year. The thing is, if you defer, you're promising you're going to come the year following. And often what happens in a year away is, you know, you learn more about yourself and you think, huh, there's another campus or two I might want to apply to. You end up applying there and then you're sort of trying to undo your promise to that college that's been holding a spot for you, which can be awkward. So I think the bravest thing to do is to, if you want to take a gap year, is not accept a spot anywhere. And instead, do that gap year and have confidence that it's only going to enhance your status as an applicant.
My guest is Julie Lithcott-Hames, former dean of freshmen at Stanford University and author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. She hosts the Slate Panoply podcast, Getting In, about the college application process. She's here with us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative, What's Next for the Class of 17. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at KERA.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Julie Lithcott-Hames, former dean of freshmen at Stanford University, host of the Slate Panoply podcast, Getting In, and author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Jeff in Plano. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. I'm just wondering if I'm being early on too overbearing. I have a daughter, 11 years old, who just took an online math exam, end of the school thing, and she had all the time in the world to finish it. There was no time limit. She got an 85, and I was like, I just felt that she could have done better, and I let her know, and boy, did I hear about it from her mom, and felt really bad. But I'm just wondering if it's, you know, at what point, you know, is that, you know, what point should I be not that overbearing? I mean, what would be the right grade at that age? Is that just too young to be that pushy about it? Or?
Thanks for your call, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for that. And we can all empathize with you in that 85. Of course, some parents are like, I wish I could see an 85. My kid got a 79, right? It's all relative. Take a look at Carol Dweck's work. She's pioneered the concept of mindset, growth mindset versus fixed mindset. We want our kids to be motivated to put their effort toward achievement, not to feel like I'm smart or I'm dumb. And that score, 85, and your disapproval of it might make her feel like that score wasn't right. But what it sounds like you're saying is that effort wasn't right. And I suppose you're really not sure. Did she put forward her best effort or, you know, did she not? And it's really that motivation to put forward her best effort that you should be very interested in. So I'd take a, you know, I'd say, you know what, honey, I realize it's not about the 85. I just want to know that every time you have a chance to do schoolwork, whether it's a test or homework, that you're trying your best. Sometimes we can't always be our best, but we want to know that you're trying hard. That's the point. And hopefully she'll develop that intrinsic motivation to always put that best foot forward.
Sometimes, Julie, students are fortunate enough to be accepted into more than one school they really like. And then there's the question of money. Given what we know about the growth of student debt, what's your advice about how much is worth taking on to get a degree from a particular school?
Boy, this is a huge issue at a macroeconomic level, I think, in our country. I think student debt is to be largely avoided. To spin it positively, I would say community college, which is, you know, on the, you know, a fraction of the cost of a four-year institution, is a great way to start a four-year degree. If finances are a concern, as they are for many, many people, community college is a great way to start out, do well, transfer to a four-year institution, get the four-year degree bearing the name of that four-year institution, but for, you know, probably less than half the cost, or just more than half the cost, I mean, of that 4 years, because you spent the first two at community college. There are two different kinds of aid when you're applying to college, and it's really important to know the difference. There's free money, aka grants or scholarships. That money is a gift to you that you never have to pay back. You want as much of that kind of aid as possible. The other type of aid is loans, okay? Those have to be repaid and with interest, and that's where the student loan debt issue comes in. So when you're looking at schools, you want to be looking at not only who gave me, you know, the most money by way of aid, but what kind of money. You want as, you know, little out-of-pocket costs for you and loan burden as possible. If you've got offers from at least two schools and one is offering more grant aid than the other, you can go back to that other school, if you'd prefer to attend it, and say, hey, we were given more grant aid from this school. Is there any way you guys could match that? Schools that have admitted you are interested in you. They're now competing for you against these other schools. So, you know, you don't want to be obnoxious about it, but it is fair to say, look, finances are obviously a huge issue. We've been offered more from them. Can you meet their offer so that we could actually find it affordable to attend your school?
What advice do you have for students who are in the horrendous purgatory of the wait list?
Yeah, the horrendous purgatory of the wait list. Often we treat our safety school as if it's a pariah. It's like there are 2,800 colleges and universities in the U.S., but if it's our safety school, we hate it. It's almost like I've gotten rejected everywhere else, but I got into my safety school, but I can't go there because it's my safety school. No, wait a minute. That school was on your list for a reason at the outset. Right. If we can start to be like, hey, that's the school that I knew I was happy to go to and I thought they'd be happy to have me. Sure enough, that turned out. I'm saying that because often someone's on a wait list hoping for an outcome on that wait list when, in fact, they're sitting with an offer from a school that was on their list originally, maybe a safety school, and now they're finding it unattractive. So I would say if that's you, look at that wait list purgatory, then look at, hey, I've been admitted to this school. Let me go back to that school and give it a visit. Let me try to re-stimulate my excitement in that school instead of feeling like I'm on hold, I'm in purgatory waiting for some school to let me off the list. Very few students come off the wait list. So, you know those odds, you know, be optimistic, great, but don't assume you're going to get in off that wait list. You know, the wait list is kind of a plan B. Plan A is what opportunity do you actually have in front of you that you can make the most of?
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Amer on the line in Plano. Hi, Amer.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Although my kids are not really at that point, they're both preschool level. I just wanted to share my experience of growing up in the inner city Chicago and going to school, high school there, with fairly good grades, and then going to private college in Chicago. But one thing I struggled with after that was actually in the work environment. So that's one thing that I didn't exactly get a training or a guidance on, and how to be, you know, PC, politically correct, and things like that.
You're talking about like soft skills, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
More or less. Yeah. So, you know, what do you have an advice for parents in that situation where the students might be doing excellent in school? Not that I did excellent, but I mean, you know, just, you know, okay to get by, and then, you know, did well in college, but then when you go in the work environment, it you kind of take a step back, and there's no way to guide you there.
Yeah, Amir, thanks for that point. I'm on the board of an organization here in East Palo Alto called Foundation for a College Education that's helping first-gen kids get to and through college. And we're really trying to hit the soft skills piece hard because it's not just about having the grades and scores. It's being able to kind of thrive in the cultural milieu of a four-year college or the workplace afterward, which might come with presumptions and assumptions about what you know based on childhood that you may not know if your childhood was poor or working class or inner city or in some other way didn't prepare you as well to thrive in, say, a white-collar workplace. You know, this is where, you know, I think how to prepare your kid. You know, your kid is already going to be benefiting from all you know, from the college experience you've had and the workplace experience you've had. This is where exposing them to things beyond the home, to cultural opportunities in the city, you know, to just the kinds of cultural experiences, art, theater, music, restaurants, you know, these are sort of things we take for granted if we frequent them as part of our own life. But our kids need to learn how to behave in those places, you know, how to sit up straight and how to look someone in the eye and how to use the right fork. And it's all, you know, it's these life skills that don't just get acquired magically. We have to teach our kids these things. And for folks who work at colleges, you know, many, many college administrators, whether they're financial aid people or academic advisors, you know, or they're advising the senior class, you know, have a sense that, and when these kids get out into the real world, they're going to need more than this transcript. You know, they're going to need to know how to conduct themselves. Essentially, that's what we're talking about. And there are, you know, there are many resources on the college campus that your kids ultimately get to that will be, you know, that will begin to teach them, you know, how to behave in the world, how to prepare for an interview. You know, how to conduct yourself when you are in the workplace. We definitely need more of that. But I think the adults in a kid's life being mindful of that, how can I, you know, not only teach them, you know, how to dress themselves and how to clean up after themselves, but how to conduct themselves with their head held high, with manners, with decorum, you know, with the sort of behavior that's expected so that they can thrive out in the world. Any one of us adults can take an interest in being that mentor for a kid that we see who may be a little rough around the edges. And actually, this is an opportunity for me to mention a great TED Talk by Josh Shipp. Every kid needs one caring adult. If every kid just had one caring adult, as per Josh Shipp, you know, their lives become lives where they can thrive. And so we can be that adult in a kid's life, whether it's our own kid or a kid we know who needs a little extra guidance, who needs someone to care about them and believe in them and envision a really glorious future for them.
I know that you've done a bit of college touring this past year with your son. We've done that at our house, too.
Yes.
But it can get expensive. So if our options are limited for going to every single school that sends a beautiful glossy brochure, how should students make decisions? And to what extent do they need to make their presence known when they're on campus?
All right. There are a couple points here. I think number one, most people can't afford to fly around the country, travel around the country to visit colleges. So fortunately, we have the internet and every school's got a website. If you don't have a sense of, you know, where to even begin with these thousands of options, the College Board, which runs the SAT and the APs, they have a lovely website called bigfuture.org, I believe. It's either .org or .com. bigfuture.org or .com. It allows you to put in your interests and it'll start to pop up, you know, schools that you might want to know about. So start to surf on the web to get more info on schools. if you, you know, if you've narrowed your list and you really wish you could visit, but you can't, you could, let's see, there's a department you're interested in at that school. Do a little research, figure out a faculty member who's teaching an interesting class, reach out to them with a question you might have about the class they're teaching, you know, to sort of demonstrate your interest in that particular subject. Colleges want to know that if they admit you, they want you to come there. So the extent to which you've demonstrated an interest in them matters, but it only matters once you've applied there. So if you're getting brochures in the mail from schools, you know, or you're getting emails because you've done well enough on a PSAT or whatever, you don't have to worry about responding to all of that now. Should you become interested in applying and actually apply, that's when you want to then reply to that email. Hey, I'm applying. I'm excited about coming to you guys. Maybe pick up the phone, call the admissions office, ask them a question. You do not have to physically visit. Many people lack the means to physically visit, and they know that. But use the phone, send an email, demonstrate your interest that way.
Okay, Julie, for students like your son who knows at a very young age that biology is probably what he wants to do, that can really narrow the list, right? Because we look for the best schools with that major and with a course of study that makes sense. Right. What do you say to students who really have no clue what they even want to major in? How do you choose a college when you don't know what your focus will be?
First thing I would say, totally normal. Nothing wrong with you. This is normal, and many kids are that way. And that's why many colleges and universities allow you to be undeclared slash undecided. Many don't expect you to declare a major until sometime in your sophomore year, even the end of your sophomore year. So if you don't know, don't force yourself to know. Don't pigeonhole yourself like, well, I guess I better major in this because it's time for me to figure it out and I don't know. Don't make that decision as a senior in high school, okay? Apply to a place that allows you to enter undecided, undeclared, and then take a myriad of classes and start to pay attention. How do I feel in this class? Am I intrigued? Am I bored? Do I love it? Do I hate it? All of that is important data that helps inform you about yourself and ultimately what you'll major in, and maybe even along the way, you know, what you might want to do with your life.
We often hear these days that it has become the rule rather than the exception that students attending at least state universities no longer take 4 years to graduate. They take 5 years or 6 years just for a bachelor's degree. What has changed since you and I were in school?
Well, I think a couple of things have changed. At big public universities, it can often be hard to get the classes you want. So that's a problematic thing, endemic in the fact too many students, not enough room in each class for all the students who want to take that class, and therefore you have to wait until there's room in the class you want, which might be a prerequisite for the next class you want. If you're certain you know what you want to major in and the school you're applying to has that kind of policy, I would really be wary because you want to know that the classes you want are going to be available. I think the other piece is, as I've written about in How to Raise an Adult, too many of our young people have had their path planned for them and have had parents so helpfully helping. They get to college and they really struggle with having to manage all of this tremendous amount of free time and autonomy that the person advising Joelle was speaking about. So, you know, I think too many kids have been overhelped and they struggle with, you know, how do I make my way? They have to know how to access the resources available at college, the academic advisors who are there for the purpose of guiding them and helping them get through. You know, they have to be motivated to do the work, to finish, and to handle the struggles that come. So, you know, my last thought here is like, I could be planning out my junior's, you know, creating the spreadsheet for him. Here are the schools he's going to apply to. Here's all the deadlines. Here's all the things he has to do. And I could just, you know, hand it to him and be his secretary, his concierge. But I know that will lead to a kid who gets to college and still needs his mom to be preparing a checklist or a spreadsheet of what he's supposed to do next. And that will impede his progress. I'd rather him apply to far fewer schools and do the work of applying to college himself than to end up at college lacking the wherewithal to be an adult.
Julie Lithcott-Hames is former dean of freshmen at Stanford University and author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. She also hosts the Slate Panoply podcast, Getting In, about the college application process. Julie, thank you so much for being with us. It's really always a pleasure.
Same here, Chris. Thanks so much.
Julie Lithcott-Hames joined us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative as we focus on what's next for the class of 17. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. And I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.